The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook if you sign up for a two-week trial of their service. Audible has 40,000 titles available to download. For all the details, follow the links at guardian.co.uk/audible.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Hello and welcome to this week's Books Podcast. It's a special one for us here in the studio because we'll be announcing the shortlist for the Guardian First Book Award. We'll also speak to one of the five authors and tell you about a competition to win a set of the shortlisted books and a pair of tickets to the First Book Award ceremony in December. We'll be hearing from one of the Waterstones reading groups who've been part of the judging process.
It's just an outstanding piece of first writing. He scores for me on the basis that I want to read what he's going to write next.
But we start with something more serious. The news over the past week has been dominated by the fallout from Chancellor George Osborne's comprehensive spending review. And while the focus has been on the arts world and the extent to which the cuts will affect services such as museums and theatres, there are also serious implications for the world of literature. Here's my colleague Sarah Crown, books editor of our website.
With me in the studio to talk about the cuts are Viv Bird, CEO of the National Charity Book Trust, which according to its website is dedicated to encouraging people of all ages and cultures to enjoy books, and Gary McKeown, Chair of Trustees of London Poetry Magazine and a former Literature Director at Arts Council England from 1995 to 2006. Also here is the author and commentator John O'Farrell, who tonight will be taking part in a debate on the literature of New Labour at the Inside Out Festival in London. Thanks to you all very much for coming in. And John, we'll come to you in a minute. I think we'll get the bad news out of the way first.
Okay.
Viv, starting with you, could you explain, first of all, for our listeners, what it is that Book Trust does and how it's funded?
Book Trust is the largest literature charity. Book Trust runs a whole range of projects, programmes, awards, literary prizes. So, for instance, in the last week, we've just had Children's Book Week. We've got four literary prizes, events happening over the next month. And in the meantime, we're distributing books to children across the country through Bookstart and Booktime.
Yes, I suppose lots of people will know you best through your work with Bookstart. Anyone who's had a child will know that you get this amazing bag of books.
Every day, they're parents with very young children who are not very confident about how to share stories with their baby. And they get this beautiful pack and parental guidance information and support for children with disabilities so that no child misses out on that important beginning of a journey towards the discovery of books. So Bookstart is great, but that is funded by the Department for Education as part of the book gifting programmes. We are, as Book Trust, a regularly funded organisation from Arts Council funding.
And so as we know, the Arts Council has had its budget cut by nearly 30%. How has that cut been translated through to you as an organisation?
This year, we've already received 0.5% to our Arts Council budget cut. And next year, we have just been told that it'll be 6.9% cuts. And at this stage, we haven't worked through what that will mean. But clearly, it will mean some reductions in what we can offer. And our funding comes not only from the public sector, from government funding, but also through some of the private sector important partnerships that we've been able to develop, such as with the BBC, with Orange, particularly with children's publishers, Pearson, but many other children's publishers. So we have to work through what the impact of these cuts will be on our partnerships, because there's a very careful positioning in terms of how we match some of the funding that we get from the private sector with our public sector funding. So we would be very concerned if the funding levels drop to a stage where we weren't able to draw in that private sector funding, which enables us to do so much.
And Gary, we think of Arts Council England, or certainly I do, as sort of primarily an arts organisation. But you were the literature director there for nearly 10 years. How involved is it in the world of books?
Well, it's very involved. I mean, there are a range of literature organisations that are funded up and down the country, from Book Trust, the Arvon Foundation, magazines like Poetry London, etc. So there is a landscape of literature organisations that have been built up over the past number of years. And what I think it is right to say is that there's not much slack in the literature sector. As alarming is the imperative from government to the Arts Council itself to reduce its costs.
Mm. You know, explain a bit about that. They've asked
that the administration of the Arts Council cost less over this same period of time. I joined the Arts Council in 1993. It was restructuring then It's still restructuring. You know, at this rate, it's going to take longer than the rise and fall of the Roman Empire. But what they have got to do is avoid losing the reservoir of knowledge and expertise that is there. The Arts Council, I don't think, can afford to reduce its core costs anymore. I don't think there's any more slack there.
It's a slightly sort of poacher-gamekeeper position yeah. you're in, because now you're chair of trustees of a small poetry magazine, Poetry London, mm-hmm. which I should actually say, just for the record, I am also a trustee of, in case emails start coming in about that. It commands a sort of small pot of money. Presumably any cut to a budget of that size is going to be very keenly felt.
Absolutely right. I mean, 2011-12, the budget will be for just over £47,000. There are three issues of the magazine published each year. There are no full-time staff, so the money is made to stretch as far as it can go in terms of editor, reviewers, marketing, distribution, printing, all of that. Our costs are going to go up over this period of time, inevitably, and the money that we have there will come down. So what do we do? Do we reduce the number of issues?
Whether we like it or not, we are now in a position, after the comprehensive spending review, that these cuts are being made
yeah.
Across the board in the UK. Obviously, I'm speaking as somebody who's very involved in literature, but is it possible to say, to make a case for spending money on literature and the arts generally, when that may be to the detriment or at the cost of frontline services such as benefits?
I think it's a really good question to pose, and I know everybody in the Arts Council would be searching their souls. But nevertheless, I think we have to kind of recognise the importance of the arts fundamentally about the engagement with not just from our perspective with books and literature and learning, but the wider cultural benefits of exploring and finding about the world through the engagement with that the arts themselves can bring.
But we shouldn't forget also that the arts are not somehow out on a limb. I have seen huge amounts of good work done via literature in the health service. I've seen huge amounts of good work done in the prison service. That's not to try and make literature some kind of panacea for all the ills of society, but it does have a contribution to make beyond the simple act of reading and writing.
I'm also here in the studio with John O'Farrell, who we know as an author, but also a commentator and somebody who's very involved in politics himself. John, what would you say in response to that?
The point is, of course, it costs money to support the arts and promote literature and reading in the way that Book Trust does. But it's more expensive not to in the long term. So the project that Book Trust has been promoting, giving books to every new reader, is fantastically economical way of promoting reading and having a workforce, you know, down, if we're going to be brutally sort of economic about it, that is well educated and gets a head start in literacy. So they could make cuts now to things like, you know, things like that, but it will cost more down the line if we have a less literate workforce, you know, in 20 years' time.
John, this evening you're speaking at a debate at the Inside Out Festival at Somerset House in London on the subject of literature under New Labour. Looking back over the past 15 years of New Labour, how has literature fared?
The New Labour government has not particularly had much impact on fiction, and we haven't seen a whole sort of tranche of novels that, you know, deal with the major angry scenes about visitor numbers to the Millennium Dome. You need major conflict to create sort of, you know, great drama. And so, you know, the miners' strike or the poll tax riots, these are the situations which, you know, ideologies clash.
You're talking about major domestic conflicts, because obviously we've had...
Well, the Iraq War actually hasn't thrown up sort of a great British novel yet. I mean, Saturday by Ian McEwan has the demonstration against the war as its backdrop, but it's not really about Iraq, although, you know, obviously themes are drawn in. I think that the problem with writing directly about British domestic politics is that the truth is actually a little bit boring. It's complex. Characters are doing their best to make, you know, they're compromising and they're sitting in meetings and they're trying to make things work better. And the great British public, bless them, don't want to hear about that. They want to hear that they're venal, corrupt. They're trying to line their own pockets. You could write a great novel about Watergate, but I don't think you could write a great novel about the traffic cones hotline.
Do you think that it's something that has to be done in retrospect, perhaps? That it might be that the themes of New Labour's time in power will only be emerged subsequently, and that somebody might go back and write the great New Labour novel later?
We have a great amount of material available to us with the all the non-fiction that is crowding out any possible novel that could possibly written about New Labour, because of the Blair memoir and the Mandelson memoir and the Alistair Campbell diaries, there's not much room in the bookshops for anything else. I think when we come to look back at the beginning of the 21st century, we won't be looking back at family income tax credits and Sure Start and all these, you know, worthy projects that were going on around the country. We will be interested in wider changes in society and the big events like the Gulf War and the Afghan War, the death of Diana or 7/7. These will be things that, you know, novelists will want to tackle. I don't think the actual business of politics, the soap opera of Westminster, will be what draws them in.
From the conversation that we've been having today, it does look as if, in terms of the arts at least, we're about to enter a less plentiful age, less government support for the sort of things that we're talking about. Do you think literature does well in an age of austerity? Because we look back now on things like the Great Depression, and it seems to have been a time of creativity, really.
The Chinese say, may you live in boring times. I wouldn't sort of call it a silver lining on the 10 years we've got coming up. So I think it probably is true that conflict and depression and, you know, major social changes does prompt writers to tackle those interesting, challenging issues. But I wouldn't wish it on anyone for that purpose alone.
I came across a project that was set up by Roosevelt during the Depression called the Federal Writers Project. And it was set up as part of the New Deal to fund written work and support writers during the Depression. And they were paid absolute peanuts. But they had work. And when you look at some of the people who emerged from it, you can see that it fostered this incredible sort of breadth of talent. We had Saul Bellow, John Cheever, Zora Neale Hurston and John Steinbeck. Do you think there's actually a case to be made, and this is sort of maybe for everybody to answer now, that we ought to invest in literature more in difficult times? And Gary, you sort of touched on this slightly.
Yeah, well, I suppose we could point to the Writers' Award scheme that was, which gave money to writers based on the merit of the work, based on assessment by their peers, and that was a good and honourable scheme. I think what we have to worry about, and I hate to be so doom-laden in this, but the Arts Council is going to have to cut back its managed funds as well, and that's the money that was available for the new project, the bright idea, the taking a risk. That's going to cut back by 21 million. That's going to be tough for the writer who is on the way with, say, a second novel or whatever and needs some time and space to write. It's going to be much tighter. Should we have the equivalent of the federal scheme that Roosevelt had? I don't know. I think our culture is slightly, again, that kind of state-bannered stuff. We'd need to be very careful on that. And what writers do now, work-wise, is they teach creative writing, they give workshops, they do all that sort of stuff as a way of fueling the art.
Viv, what about you?
Well, I think it's really important that writers are encouraged to write, but they also need readers to read what they write. And that's what Book Trust is about, and getting more people to enjoy that experience of reading and books. You know, and I think some of the big things that we can do, even perhaps small, or on a smaller scale, the 10 Best New Illustrators Award, we're starting again, encouraging more illustrators of picture books to come into the fore and be recognised as artists. The Roald Dahl Funny Prize that we launched 2 years ago, celebrating funny books, the BBC Shorts National Short Story Award, all these things actually encourage an interest in different genres of writing and books. And I think together we can find ways to do things. So I do think we need to be a little bit upbeat, but realistic about things that may have to go in that process. We can't do it all, but I think we can find ways to continue to do creative ways and really celebrate literature and their creativity that is undoubtedly there and will be in the future.
You know, if we've done nothing else over the last 10 or 12 years, we've established the fact that reading is part of this creative process, and there is a lot more support for readers and reading than there was 10, 15 years ago.
John, what? If there was a Federal Writers Project, would you...
Do you know, I think I was on it. I think I was trained up by the BBC as a writer, and an open door policy for uncommissioned writers to walk into the BBC Light Entertainment Comedy Department and give their sketches to the producer, and that's how I got into comedy writing. And that's not so easy to do now, and that's partly the reason I set up a comedy website where writers submit jokes online and stories online, and via Newsbiscuit, various people have got into comedy writing, and one of them's actually got a book deal, which is fantastic. But, you know, the English language is this wonderful sort of brand that we don't realise we have in this country. And when cuts are made to things like the World Service or to the world of British writing, I think we are mad, because this is a way we have to talk to the whole world. That we're way ahead of the French and the Germans, and that we've got this language, and our books can reach around the world and sell Britain.
Thanks to Viv Bird, Gary McKeown and John O'Farrell for coming in to join us.
So now to our annual First Books Prize. After several weeks of discussion by our Waterstones reading groups all across the country, and of course our own distinguished judges, we have come up with a shortlist. It is as follows. Your presence is requested at Suvanto by Myla Chapman, Jonathan Cape. Being Wrong, Adventures in the Margin of Error by Catherine Schultz, Portobello Books. Black Mamba Boy by Nadifa Mohammed, Harper. Boxer Beetle by Ned Bowman, Scepter. Romantic Moderns, English Writers, Artists and the Imagination from Virginia Woolf to John Piper, that's by Alexandra Harris and is published by Thames and Hudson. We hope to be talking to all the authors of the chosen books over the coming weeks leading up to the final decision by the judges. This week we met Ned Bowman, whose first novel is Boxer Beetle. Coincidentally, it was the favourite of the Waterstones Oxford Reading Group, meeting for their weekly discussion in their chosen venue, the rather noisy Harcourt Arms in Jericho.
Okay, well, my name's William. I work for Waterstones, and I'm running the Oxford Reading Group, the very first book award this year. And what we've been doing is, over the past few weeks, we've been looking at the 10 books on the long list and discussing them each one in turn. We'll be spending, say, 2 hours in each. We'll write a review for each one and send them off to Stuart Broom back at the Waterstones head office. And what we're gathered here tonight to do is to chew the fat about our final scores for the top 10. And we've already collated some provisional scores over the weekend. Simon now, who's gathered all the scores for everyone, put them all together in a nice little spreadsheet, which will give us some idea for the round wise.
So we have a provisional shortlist and sort of ranking for the entire long list. So we're in order. Boxer Beetle we have ranked first, then Mr. Chartwell, then Romantic Moderns, then Your Presence is Requested at Savanta, which has to be one of the longest names for a book ever. Bomber County coming in fifth, then Being Wrong, Things We Didn't See Coming, Floating Man the Poetry, and at the bottom, Black Mamba Boy and Curfew Night. Boxer Beetle is one of two books that we've all agreed should be on the shortlist.
We all
agreed on Boxer Beetle and Mr. Chartwell as two to go through. And Boxer Beetle, for a writer so young, he is so in control of his form, his material, his comedy, his drama, his period feel. Because I know Eleanor was particularly enamoured of the way he evoked the 1930s. And it's just an outstanding piece of first writing. And he scores for me on the basis that I want to read what he's going to write next. It almost doesn't matter what it is, I want to read Ned Bowman's second book.
Well, I agree with you. That is one of our judging criteria, isn't it? Do we want to read their second book, and are we looking forward to what they write next?
Want to lock him up into a little room and say, write more, write more.
I was just astounded that he could make it all up. He could have conceived a plot that just came together, it worked, it all fit into place, and I think I did see the back of the book and the cover, and I did think this could be very pretentious and very trendy without having much substance, but as Simon said, it was moving, hilarious, it all came together. It made you want to think about things like invented languages.
Yeah, it was very accomplished, very confident. But what's interesting about it is that it bears all the elements that you criticise in Romantic Moderns, in that scattergun approach. He takes in Nazi memorabilia and entomology and eugenics and boxer with nine toes and medical conditions. And then there's the country house section where he puts his characters into Claremore.
And I think I would probably be the only one to sound a little note of dissent, because I did enjoy this
too,
but I felt that it was overwritten, and where you've all said you wanted more, I actually wanted less.
Yes, I agree with you, because I felt that the authorial voice was too overpowering. He made his characters very, very clever, all of them.
I thought it was a really clever, really funny book. I thought it was really exuberant, and I loved it. I was sitting on the bus one day, I was roaring with laughter, because I just found the whole book so clever and so funny. and there's a woman leaning over my shoulder as just as I'm reading the bit about wanking, and it was so funny.
Yeah, having me in there, coming back from Belfast as well, nice old Irish granny sitting beside me reading over my shoulder. I turned the page very quickly.
Well, they certainly liked it. And with me now in the studio, beaming from top to toe, is Ned Bowman himself. Ned, could you start by giving us a taste of Box of Beetles so we can see why they were so fired up?
In idle moments, I sometimes like to close my eyes and imagine Joseph Goebbels' 43rd birthday party. I like to think that even in the busy autumn of 1940, Hitler might have found time to organise a surprise party for his close friend. Pretending for weeks that the date had slipped his mind, deliberately ignoring the propaganda minister's increasingly sulky and awkward hints, and waiting until the very last order had been dispatched to his U-boat commanders on the evening of Tuesday the 29th of October, before he led Goebbels on some pretext into the cocktail lounge of the Reich Chancellery. A great shout of Alles Gute zum Geburtstag, a cascade of streamers, some relieved and perhaps even slightly tearful laughter from Goebbels himself as he embraced the Führer, and the party could begin. All this is conjecture, of course, but what is certain is that at some point on that day, Hitler presented Goebbels with his birthday present, an exquisite 15-volume illustrated edition of the complete works of Goethe, published in Stuttgart in 1881 by J.G. Gotthafschen, bound in red Morocco leather with a gilded spine and marbled edges. One can't help feeling sorry for the soldiers of the 101st US Airborne Division who, nearly 5 years later, broke into a boarded-up salt mine near Berchtesgaden and splintered the schnapps crates piled inside to find not gold bullion, nor the holy spear of destiny that pierced Christ's side, nor even a single consolatory bottle of schnapps, but instead Goebbels' personal library, stashed there in haste when the war began to turn against the Nazis. Nonetheless, somebody was dutiful enough to make sure the books escaped the bonfires, and they were shipped back to the Library of Congress in Washington. Meanwhile, the vast majority of Hitler's 16,000 books, along with his skull and Eva Braun's underwear, were captured by the Red Army and to this day lie mouldering in an abandoned Baroque church on the Uzko estate near Moscow, which I can only assume is, by some distance, the spookiest building in the entire world. The book collection wouldn't even be unpacked until 1952, when the job was given to a college student on work experience who probably wished he was helping out at a summer camp. By then, the Gotthafschen Goethe, with its fond inscription by Hitler and scattered marginalia by Goebbels, had escaped onto the open market. And some 50 years later, it passed into the hands of Horace Grublock, the London property developer who, until his violent death earlier this year, was an irregular employer of mine. Between 2002 and 2007, Grublock gave me 3 volumes, from Prometheus through to Iphigenie Avtaris, in exchange for errands, promising that one day, if I were loyal, I'd collect the whole set. It was humiliating, but Grublock said he'd never sell, and even if he did, the sort of dealers who could handle the Goebbels, Gotthafschen, Goethe wouldn't have taken so much as a telephone call from the likes of me, Kevin Broom, and even if they would, I could never have afforded it, so I had no choice. That's why, one day in September, when Grublock called at 10 o'clock on a Thursday night, back when I'd never even heard of the town of Roachmorton, I ran for my phone with toothpaste still dribbling from my mouth, knowing it had to be him. "Fishy," he said. "Yes, Horace?" "You remember that private investigator who's been doing a spot of work for me, Zhozhak?" "I think so." "He's supposed to check in every evening by telephone, but he's missed 2 nights now without any warning. I've tried to call him myself and there's no answer. Drive over and see if he's all right." "To his office?" "He doesn't have an office. He works out of his home like a suburban palm reader. It's in Camden. It'll only take you 10 minutes. He gave me the address. "What's he doing for you?" "You know perfectly well I can't tell you, Fishy. As contingently loyal as you may be to me, I know your real allegiance is to your internet friends. Unless by any chance you've heard of a fellow called Seth Roach." "I hadn't." "That's that then. Off you go." I am often asked the question, why would you become a collector of rare Nazi memorabilia unless you are yourself a secret Nazi? Or anyway, I expect I would often be asked that question if anyone knew about my hobby beyond Grublock, my former cleaning lady Maria, and, as Grublock calls them, my internet friends. I'm not a secret Nazi. I feel sick when I think about what they did. So do you, probably. And if just the thought can provoke a spurious little shiver of survivor's guilt, imagine what it's like to pick up an SS dagger in your hand. I don't know of any experience like it. You feel as if you're doing something terribly wrong, and yet you know it can't be wrong because you're doing no harm to anyone. It's stupid and exhilarating and revelatory. Normally, you can't get a proper look at your own conscience because it only ever comes out to gash you with its beak, and you just want to do whatever you can to push it away. But put your conscience in the cage of this paradox, where it can slither and bark, but it can't hurt you, and you can study it for as long as you like. Most people don't truly know how they feel about the Holocaust because they're worried that if they think about it too hard, they'll find out they don't feel sad enough about the 6 million dead. But I'm an expert in my own soul.
Well, Ned, my goodness, you go in as you mean to continue, don't you? You're not sort of saving any blows for sensitive readers there.
Yeah, actually, it originally started with a boxing scene because I love the way Underworld by Don DeLillo starts right in the middle of that baseball match. So I wanted to do something similar to that. But then I decided I wanted to establish Fishy's voice straight away as the narrator, as the guy who's telling all this.
Mm-hmm. Let's just tease through some of the strands of it. You heard there from Kevin Fishy, who suffers from a rare disease. It does actually exist. This, I had to look it up.
Yeah, trimethylaminuria. And lots of people assume I've made it up, but actually it is real. And a friend of a friend had a kid who had it, and the baby was born. The baby smelt terrible. None of the doctors knew what it could be because this disease is so rare. And then someone finally worked out that it's this sort of gene disorder where you can't break down certain proteins properly. So your sweat, breath and urine all stink of rotting fish.
Oh my goodness. But it actually serves a plot purpose for you, doesn't it? It keeps Fishy, Kevin, very isolated.
I love Raymond Chandler, and I've always wanted to do something narrated by a private investigator of sorts, but I wanted to make my narrator the opposite of a kind of suave Philip Marlowe type. The opposite in every way. So I wanted to make him awkward, reclusive, uncharismatic, geeky, difficult to talk to. And then I'd heard about this disease years ago and stored it away. And I thought, what better way is there, yeah, to keep someone in their flat than something which makes you stink of fish?
So now, although what triggers the plot is that is the discovery of this dead detective, actually what he discovers is historical, and it takes us right back to the 1930s, hence the second strand. Tell us a bit about this strand.
Yeah, the majority of the book is about the doomed relationship between a upper-class gentleman scientist called Philip Erskine and a young boxer from Hoxton called Seth Roach, who's nicknamed Sinner. And they, over the course of the mid-30s, their paths sort of cross again and again in various ways. And the conceit of the book is that Fishy, the narrator, is sort of investigating what happened to them and in the process telling us the story.
Now, Philip Erskine is a eugenicist, among other things,
yeah,
and a researcher of beetles. He's doing things which probably we shouldn't reveal to people who haven't read the book yet, because
no,
that's part of
quite
the plot,
late
isn't
on, yeah,
it? And as we said, Seth Roach is a nine-toed, under 5 foot boxer in the East End. This is obviously quite heavily researched, is it? I mean, you've got some set pieces, including a big black shirts rally.
Yeah.
Tell us about how you went about finding out about this.
It started on Wikipedia, which I used to browse a lot looking for sort of historical arcana. And I came across Anophthalmus hitleri, the Hitler beetle, on the same day as I came across this 19th century Australian boxer called Jim Hall, whom you shouldn't look up if you haven't read the book, because actually the story in the book is so close to his real life that if you read his Wikipedia entry, the book will be a bit spoiled for you. And once I decided to put those in the same book, I tried to start accreting other historical themes and oddities which might fit together. So yeah, I started on Wikipedia, but then once I got into it, obviously I researched much deeper. So I spent, you know, weeks and weeks in libraries.
So now, apart from the historical stuff, you've got quite a lot of, as you described it, as phony science or bogus,
yeah,
science. But it isn't. It wasn't. I mean, you cite Darwin along the way, don't you? You bring in a huge number of references.
Erskine, the basis of what he's doing is eugenics as a science, as propounded by Francis Galton, who was Darwin's cousin. And yeah, most of the eugenics in the book is stuff that Galton suggested. Indeed, a lot of the experiments. So, for instance, the one at the end of the third chapter, in which you cut open the arteries of two rabbits and then reroute their bloodstream so that each one's heart pumps the other's blood, is a real thing that Galton did to see if black rabbits and white rabbits were sort of incompatible in a very deep way. And he discovered that they weren't, because you can just splice them together like that. And Galton was a relatively respectable scientist, and he certainly didn't propose liquidating the undesirable. But after him, a lot of people came who were total crackpots and often in quite evil ways.
And you twist this, you get a lot of comedy out of this, don't you? But it's not obvious comedy.
Eugenicists of that time, and also British fascists, in my research I found you don't have to work very hard to make them funny. They were all just such preposterous people, and they wrote these ominous things about the decline of civilization, which just are really funny. I feel like they must have been funny even at the time, but they're certainly funny now.
Now, you counterpose this sort of quite creepy social upper-class comedy of these sort of people who are very well connected and thought they knew exactly what was going on, with actually almost a sort of Jacobean name-calling comedy of the East End, don't you? Kevin's nickname is Fishy, you've got Sinner, you've also got characters called Pock and Mottle, and we've heard about Grublock. Names, obviously, are part of the fun of this.
Rather than looking through like a telephone directory for names, as a lot of writers do, I try and just conjure a phoneme out of the air that will work, which means that most of the names end up feeling a bit implausible. But, well, a lot of people have compared my use of names to Dickens, not favourably, but in the sense that it feels like almost a Dickensian pastiche. And in fact, Grublock, one of the first readers of an early draft, said that that name was absurd sounding and it sounded like it could only have come out of Dickens. And I said, no, I came up with that and it sums up my sense of the character. And then I Googled it just to check, and there is indeed a Grublock in Dickens.
It's a huge mishmash of genres, isn't it? Or maybe that's not a very flattering. It plays with genre. Yeah. So you've got detective fiction, you've got Dickensian realist novel, you've got historical novel, all these things going on at the same time. How did you come up with this formula?
Well, like all my writing, I really like the thought that it can feel quite disjointed and have things that shouldn't really be allowed to be in the same book. But I think it's also a sense of a book takes a very long time to write. If I hadn't had this published, who knows whether I ever would have got around to writing another one. So you start a book thinking, I want to put everything I like about books into this one book, which is why I had to have a detective in it, because I want a book with a detective, but I had to have all the other stuff as well. There was nothing that I was willing to leave out. There are quite a lot of lunges from genre to genre in a way that I really enjoy.
How old are you?
25.
You're 25. Now, I have a picture of you being a real geek, that sort of geek who sits up sort of into the early hours of the morning, trawling through the internet, finding all these bits of arcane stuff. Is that
true? That is fully accurate, yeah.
And you said that a former flatmate called you Auton after Doctor Who, yeah. A Doctor Who cyborg.
Yeah.
So, you know, where is the humanity of your figures, of your characters?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, a lot of people have said that if there's one thing they don't like about the book, it's a bit cold. I would say, so for instance, I never set out to write a book about what it's like to be a teenage boy, because to me that's a really dull theme. But after I'd finished the book, in fact, it took until it was published before I looked at it and thought, actually, the three main characters, the Fishy and Sinner and Erskine, do, and I think this must have come out of me unconsciously, kind of represent for me the three aspects of what teenage experience is like. So I think maybe the humanity is in there, and that from Fishy, I try to be quite vivid about his incredible discomfort about interacting with other people and even about leaving his flat. With Sinner, try and be quite vivid about his just unbridled libido and kind of recklessness. And then Erskine, again, his squeamishness and his conceitedness and his stuck-upness. So I hope if any of the book is emotionally authentic and not so cold, then I hope it's those more real aspects of those three characters.
Mm. Now, to what extent is this a Jewish novel?
I am technically Jewish in that my mother was Jewish and her mother was Jewish and so on, but I've never set foot in a synagogue. I know almost nothing about it. Recently, I was chatting to the author, Naomi Alderman, who her first novel was about an Orthodox Jewish community, and she asked me to tell her when the Sabbath was, and I got it right on the third try, although it's kind of a trick question because it's across 2 days. But anyway, so I know nothing really about Jewishness. But on the other hand, it is the case that if Hitler had had his way, then I would not exist because most of my grandparents would not have lived long enough to have my parents. So I have at least a superficial connection to the 20th century Jewish experience, I like to think, which makes me feel like a bit less of a subcultural tourist. Judaism is kind of too big a theme to be a metaphor for something else, but perhaps in this book it is a metaphor for any kind of oppressed or misunderstood subsection of a larger intolerant whole.
Mm-hmm. You're taking quite a lot of liberties with the reader, aren't you? You're very confident they're going to stay with you. You're dealing with very dark subjects, you're dealing with them very front on, you're playing postmodern games with them that they might not like. Why do you think they would stay with you?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I don't have, you know, an ideal reader in my mind, but you have to write for the most indulgent one rather than the least indulgent one, I think. Otherwise, you'll never produce anything of interest. A lot of people in reviews have said, yeah, it's unpleasant, it's, you know, politically incorrect, it's not for the squeamish and so on. Which I actually never expected. I never thought of it as being a shocking book at all. And I really don't think it is. Like, in the same bookshops where you can buy my book, you can buy Hubert Selby Jr. or William Burroughs or Bret Easton Ellis. And the thought that compared to, you know, when those are on the same shelves, that there's anything that's going to turn anyone's stomach in my book, I really don't think. But then maybe people are more sensitive than I realise.
Ned Bowman, one of the five new authors who've got through to the shortlist of our Guardian First Books Award. Boxer Beetle is published by Scepter. Now, you can win a collection of all the books in our quiz, plus a pair of tickets to our sparkly awards ceremony at London's V&A Museum on December the 1st by answering the questions on the front page of this podcast. We'll be hearing from the other authors over the next few weeks. Do please leave your own comments on the shortlisted books, plus your views about the arts cuts on the podcast page. If you've come to hear us through iTunes, the address to find us at is guardian.co.uk/books. Ned Bowman pops up again in the Guardian Saturday Review to answer a Q&A about writing Boxer Beetle. Plus, we'll be looking at Mark Twain's autobiography, published to mark the centenary of his death. For the ghoulies and ghosties among you, The Observer's new review will run a Halloween roundup of ghost stories on Sunday. I'm Claire Armistead, and our producer this week is Tim Mabey. Thanks for listening. And goodbye.
Don't forget to start your free 14-day trial of audible.co.uk and to download your free audiobook. Head to guardian.co.uk/audible.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.